Welcome to the Technocracy NewsHour. I'm Patrick Wood. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Timothy Ball, a Canadian geographer and historical climatologist. He's well known for his opposition to the scientific consensus in the global warming controversy. A retired professor, he taught in the Department of Geography at the University of Winnipeg from 1971 to 1976. Welcome, Dr. Timothy Ball, to the Technocracy NewsHour. I thank you very much for coming on with us, and we're just going to get right into our discussion on climate change and what that means to the world today, and especially because there is a great meeting coming up in Paris at the end of this month, the end of November, that will be the mother of all climate change summits, so they say. So welcome to the program, Dr. Ball.
Well, thank you for the opportunity and the opportunity to present what people are not hearing. And I think I'd start with that, them posing that question to themselves, why aren't we hearing this information? And I think that in itself is informative.
I think that it is. And everybody kind of has a sense today that the press, especially the media in the United States, I'm sure in Canada it's the same, but we're not really practicing journalism anymore, at least investigative journalism. And it seems to be that there is a distinct narrative that the media has picked up that it will play no matter what, no matter what evidence is given to it, no matter what really new factual revelations are put out. They just seem to parrot the same old stuff day after day after day.
Yeah, well, of course, this was the concern of the founding fathers. You know, they realized that an independent media was absolutely essential to maintaining the agenda and keeping America on its track. But Jefferson had very short shrift with the media itself. And today, of course, it is now purely political. It's got a political agenda. And what's interesting is that in Britain, you get newspapers, for example, which don't hide their political agenda. For example, if you want the socialist view, you get the Manchester Guardian, or the Guardian as it's now called. If you want the conservative view, you get the Times or the Daily Telegraph. And biases are only a problem if you're not aware of them. The great problem in North America is papers like the New York Times or the Globe and Mail in Canada pretending to represent across the spectrum views, when in fact they're coming at it with a very, very biased view. And it's that hypocrisy and deception that is a lot of the problem.
Why do you suppose that that the media consistently presents this other, the alternative side, the false side? Who got to them first that they pick up the narrative that we hear all the time?
Well, I think that there's a couple of answers to that. One is, of course, that just like with most school teachers, they tend to be to the left in their political persuasion, and then in the media, very much the same thing. They see themselves, especially the new young modern journalists, as do-gooders. That they are, that they are going to correct society's ills, and so what they confuse journalism that is strict, as you said, investigative journalism presenting all sides of the issue, with opinion. That became a problem in newspapers a little while ago, and newspapers started to divide. So you'd have the editorial on one side, then you'd have an op-ed on the other side. Mm-hmm. But the other side of it is, of course, that most of these young journalists and even middle-aged people now are products of the whole environmental approach to everything, that we're here to save the planet, that's our job, and environmentalism has become a religion, and it's an indoctrination through the school system. And what we're looking at now are the products of that in the journalism field. The other thing is, of course, that a lot of these people are also both in the news media and but also in bureaucracies are the product of the 60s. These are the the hippies of the world, that the flower power and ignoring the realities of life and what actually is important. And so it's that combination that is particularly biased within the media in general. And we could limit it. Some people say, well, it's just the mainstream media. But so much of the local media is caught up in it as well, because they simply get their stories off the mainstream media. So they're all from AP and all these various news agencies. And of course, what happens is that if a story gets repeated often enough, it becomes a fact.
Right. And you know, I want to pick up a little bit on something you said about climate change having some of the nature of a religious experience. Yep. And I've been tracking this myself, and it's a curious thing that it has a lot of earmarks of a cult.
Yep.
And when I say a cult, I mean it has a position, it has a religion that it adheres to no matter what evidence is presented to the contrary. And if that was the only thing, it might not be so bad, but these people demand that you believe as they believe. And if you don't believe as they believe, they would like to punish you.
Yep.
That's exactly what Al Gore said a couple of months ago. And there's also a movement now. In fact, I think there's a lawsuit that's going to be filed, at least in, I think, New York against Exxon.
Yep.
Over climate change, you know, hiding data and, you know, whatever. And, you know, there's calls by some scientists to use the U.S. law, the RICO law, to persecute people who are, criticizing the traditional climate change policy. And it has a lot of the marks of a cult.
Totally. And of course, what's interesting about all of this is that those approaches and ideas are the very antithesis of science.
Yes.
Science, and where you see that, Patrick, is in when global warming began and people like me were saying, well, yes, there is warming, but it's not caused by humans. So we were marginalized by being called global warming skeptics. And that's one of the things that you can watch for, that you marginalize people that dare to question by giving them a term. So, for example, if you dare to ask about President Obama's academic record at Columbia, you're immediately called a birther, mm-hmm. which then says, oh, well, he's one of those birthers. The more general term that's used to marginalize you is, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. As if conspiracies don't occur. And so global warming skeptic was applied to people that dared to question the official position that humans were causing global warming. The irony, of course, is that all scientists must be skeptics. If you're not a skeptic, you're not a scientist. But what they're playing on there is the definition of the word, because skeptic in scientific terms is very different than the use of the word skeptic in general conversation in the public. Because to the public, a skeptic is somebody who's, oh, you're just cynical about everything, you don't believe anything. So it's completely different terminologies, but it works very well. What also, of course, reflects this pigeonholing of people or marginalizing of people was that when the global warming hypothesis, because that's what it was, a scientific hypothesis, the public term for that would be speculation, when that started to prove to be wrong, and it started to prove to be wrong because they said if CO2 increases, the temperature will increase, well, starting around 2000, the temperature started to level off, but the CO2 continued to increase. So in other words, one of the major assumptions of the scientific hypothesis was wrong. What good science would do is say, hey, there's something wrong with our science. But they didn't do that. What they did was they moved the goalpost by changing the name. So global warming became climate change. But then they had to create a new epithet, a new marginalizing of the climate change people. People that dared to question that. And they then became climate change deniers. In other words, they upped the ante because the term denier, with all the Holocaust connotations, marginalized those people even more in the public mind. And so that was, that's what went on. But back to your question about the cult, this all of what we're talking about now is an ongoing part of the evolution of science and the evolution of history. One of the things that is interesting about the whole environmental movement, and by the way, we needed the environmental movement. It makes sense not to soil your own nest. It makes sense to stop doing things that are potentially causing health problems and deaths. Everybody agrees with that. But what happens with this is what they call a paradigm shift. So starting in the 60s, the whole environmental issue came into being. But what happens when a paradigm shift occurs is that people kind of look at it and say, yeah, there's some good ideas there. But they're worried about it because it's change. And people have an inherent fear of change because they know from history that when change occurs, somebody gets hurt and it might just be them. And so they tend to be conservative and resist change. Not that they disagree with it, but they're just very cautious about it. However, when a new paradigm like this comes into being, there are always a small group of people who see both political and or financial opportunity and gain for them. So there was the extreme environmentalist grabbed this and said, hey, here's a lovely political agenda that we can use to push our own political agenda of controlling people by telling the sky is falling and you better vote for me and you better support me because I can stop the sky falling and save you from all of that. So that's the sense in which it's a cult. But on a larger scale, Patrick, it goes back to, and here's the interesting contradiction, because in the environmental movement amongst the extreme environmentalists, there's this anti-humanity that people are the problem. We're the ones that are causing all of this. That the holes in the ozone and the global warming is all due to what humans, those evil humans, are doing. And what's interesting about that is the same people that argue that humanity is the curse, that we've got to reduce the number of people and we've got to stop a lot of the things they're doing, those same people also believe in Darwin, and that this is we're animals like all the others, and this is all part of evolutionary development. So there's an absolute philosophical contradiction in what they're saying and what they're doing. They never think about it like that because, of course, they're blinded by their cult view and their political view. And it's interesting because science cornered itself into this problem because it chose Darwin, and he would have opposed it himself. In fact, even on his deathbed, he said there were a lot of problems with his theory. But Darwin, as a good naturalist, he wasn't a scientist because they didn't use the term at that time, would have challenged what's going on. But they used Darwin to defeat religion, and that is, I'm not here in defense of religion. All I'm telling you is what's happened historically and in the evolution of where we are today. And by getting rid of religion, you get rid of, in the public's mind, the reason for humans being here and the reason for humans being different than all the other animals. And, of course, that's the great debate that's going on. You see Richard Dawkins and his support of Darwin and evolutionary theory and, you know, God is dead and all of those arguments that you see out there in the world today. These are all an extension of that. Where you see it in universities And this goes back to what we started out by talking about, is that when Darwin was in university, there were only two faculties. There was the Faculty of Natural Sciences, and then there were the Faculty of Humanities. Now, the humanities involved religion, language, literature, history, and so on. And then, of course, the natural sciences were biology, physics. And what's interesting, by the way, about this, and a lot of people don't know this today, is that mathematics was in the humanities side of things. Because at many universities today, if you take only a math major with no other science courses, you get an arts degree, you don't get a science degree. Because math is pure logic, and where do they teach pure logic? But in philosophy courses. And philosophy courses are in the humanities, not in the natural sciences. So this gives you an idea of a lot of the confusion that's going on and why it's evolved. Now, once you, and by the way, at the time that Darwin published, 1859, he was reluctant to publish. He didn't want to publish. His friends were pushing him, and they were pushing him particularly because a guy by the name of Alfred Russel Wallace had already written to Darwin with a 42-page essay outlining what became Darwin's evolutionary theory. Wallace had already worked this out for himself, and Darwin's friends were saying, hey, this guy's going to get credit. You're going to get upstaged. You've got to get published out there. One of the questions that Wallace posed, and he basically introduced the concept, he didn't use the term, but he introduced the concept of intelligent design, which is also part of the debate that's going on. And Wallace said, look, in your theory, you have to explain why humans are so totally different than any other animal. That if you start to think about, even mathematics or the technologies or the any, you take anything that we do, there's not an animal that's even close to that, a language or anything else. Now, you notice in Darwin's Origin of the Species, he never mentions humans at all. He ignores the problem completely. And, of course, Wallace gets after him about that. So eventually Darwin published The Ascent of Man as an answer to Wallace's charges. But you read The Ascent of Man, what Darwin does in that is he tries to argue that there are other animals doing all of the same things that humans are doing. Well, I'm sorry, and that's, by the way, where that joke came up about, if you gave a bunch of chimpanzees typewriters, they'd eventually type out the works of Shakespeare. That's where that ludicrous joke came from. Now, what happened in the universities and amongst academia and the young people was, once you've removed God as the explanation for humans being here and being different from the other animals, then you're left with a vacuum. How do you explain that difference? And as I said, Wallace intimated intelligent design, and a lot of people are arguing for that. That's not really satisfactory. So what happened was, for the young people, into that vacuum of, because we are, above all else, the moral ape, there into that vacuum came the need for a belief system, and that became environmentalism. So it effectively became a religion to replace Christianity, particularly, because if you look at the other religions, they don't have any problem with this. One of the interesting things about the whole Muslim debate is go and look at what the Muslims think about humanity and how different we are from the other animals and all the rest of it. They're not even discussing the issue. Mm-hmm. And so this starts to put into perspective the idea of how environmentalism became a cult. And, of course, now what you've got going on in the universities is a complete overthrow of the traditions of science and the traditions of academia. Because what happened was that in the old days, the old professors and the older guard taught the prevailing wisdom. They said, look, this is what we know, and this is what we believe, and this is what we understand. Then the new young people came in and challenged that. What's happening now is that the new young people are coming into universities totally indoctrinated into the environmental religion, and they're going into the schools of journalism and elsewhere. The people that are challenging now that ideology are the old guys like me and like Fred Singer, who's in his 90s, and they're saying no. You're now totally indoctrinated. You're not practicing science. You're not practicing the progress of ideas and debate. And so that's how they've managed to turn this whole thing upside down. I'm sorry, that's a bit of a long-winded story, but it kind of gives a context for why you're able to say that this has all of these symptoms of a cult.
You bet. That's really good background. I want to turn our attention towards the Paris Climate Summit at the end of this month. I believe it starts on November 30 and goes through Yes. December 11. A lot of press has been given to this. There's a number of articles appearing every day now in the media somewhere in the world, stating something like the balance of humanity hangs, and whatever Yep. is all important, and if we don't solve it this time, we're all going to be doomed, and so on and so on. And this comes on the heels of the 2030 Agenda conference that was held on September 20. In New York City. That's the one that the Pope came to speak.
Yep.
And they created...
And by the way, appearing before Congress and mixing religion and politics. And it's a... Where were the ACLU complaining about that?
Oh, no, I know. There yeah. was nobody... Yeah, the Pope gets a free pass, for
yeah,
sure.
Of course.
Yes. But the 2030 Agenda document yep. that was approved by some 180 nations, and then there was also along with that, of course, there was the new Sustainable Development Goals, which replaced yep. the Millennium Development Goals, the so-called MDGs that were created in the year 2000, but those expire at the end of this year. So that partly was the purpose of the 2030 Agenda conference at the United Nations in September. And so this climate change summit comes right between the September meeting for the 2030 Agenda and the actual start date, which would be January 1 of 2016, of these new SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. And I have observed now historically that sustainable development, as it's proposed by the United Nations, it seems to be the goal of their efforts. But climate change is seemingly being used as the velvet hammer, if you will, to get people to panic and stampede into sustainable development. So here we have this climate change summit coming up at the end of this month. The head of climate change at the United Nations, Christiana Figueres, says this is going to be the biggest conference probably within 15 years in either direction. And she actually opined on a video recently that if they don't get their agenda done this November, December, that it will take them another 10 to 15 years to build momentum to where it is today. So even on the inside of this, they see that there's some risk going on. Some countries are starting to scratch their heads and wonder, are we going to get hosed again on this, and who's going to pay for all this stuff, et cetera, et cetera. But in your view on this, what is the deal coming up at this Paris Climate Change Summit?
Well, the Paris Climate Change Conference, and by the way, that sequence of the meeting before the meeting and then the summit and then the funding, that's always been the pattern. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. The Paris Conference is actually officially COP21. COP stands for Conference of the Parties. And when Maurice Strong who's now, by the way, hiding out in China because the U.S. government wants him for fraud. He set up the United Nations Environment Program in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. George Herbert Walker Bush refused to go. He said, no, it's just a political agenda, and using environment for a political agenda, he would not participate in it. He was absolutely right. And subsequently, of course, the U.S. Senate voted against one of the outcomes of that whole thing, and that was the Kyoto Protocol. They voted 95-0 against it. But the Conference of the Parties were set up as the political vehicle to advance the climate change agenda. Now, what Maurice Strong did was he took the views of the Club of Rome, which were expounded starting in the early 1960s, 61, 62. And the Club of Rome took the Malthusian view, and this is Thomas Malthus, the person in the 19th century who said the world's overpopulated, and he made the simple cause-effect correlation and said that the population is outgrowing the food supply. He was absolutely wrong, totally wrong, but that idea that the population is putting a demand on resources was taken up by the Club of Rome in the 60s. Maurice Strong was a very, very important member of that, as were Gorbachev and a few other very, very influential and powerful people, the Rockefellers and so on. So the Club of Rome took that idea of the population would outgrow the food supply and applied it to everything. They said the population will outgrow all resources, and that's where they introduced the term in a very simplistic computer model they produced called limits to growth. In other words, what they were saying is we've got to reduce the population, we've got to reduce the developed nations' populations because they're the ones that are using the resources at a greater rate than any other nation. And so that was the underlying idea. One of the people that was influential in this was Paul Ehrlich at Stanford University. There are other people. And in fact, Ehrlich published a book with John Holdren, who is now Obama's science czar, who's really pushing the whole climate change agenda. He's the one that came up with the term polar vortex, which is a completely unscientific term. He's the one that came up with the term climate disruption. He's the one that, through John Kerry, influenced the Pope to become part of this. But he was publishing with Paul Ehrlich. They published a book called Environment, Resources, and Population in the 1970s. They made predictions about, and Ehrlich, by the way, published the population bomb that was underlying all of this. Their predictions in all of that were completely wrong, but nonetheless, it gained momentum, and you still hear people saying, well, okay, I agree with you that the climate's not a problem, but overpopulation is a problem. It's another of the myths. It's simply false, but this was part of it. Now, here's the thing. Maurice Strong, in a book called The Cloak of Green, written by a proper investigative journalist by the name of Elaine Dewar, D-E-W-A-R, she interviewed him for 5 days in his offices at the United Nations after the Rio conference and said, well, look, what's going on here? And he said, look, the problem for the world is the developed nations, that they're using up the resources at too great a rate, and it's our responsibility to get rid of the industrialized nations. They are the problem. Well, think about that. And she said to him, well, why don't you run for politics if that's a concern? He then made probably the only honest comment he's ever made in his life where he said, you can't do anything as a politician. She said, well, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going to go to the United Nations and I'm going to where I can get all the money I want and not be accountable to anybody. That's precisely what he did. And I want audience to think about how would you get rid of an industrialized nation? Well, what they did was they decided that the industrialized nations had gained their advantage through the use of fossil fuels. That had given America its great advantage and the developed nations their advantage. And the byproduct of fossil fuels was CO2. And so they then set about creating the science to show that CO2 was causing global warming. That was done by Strong in his structure and organization at the United Nations Environment Program that was introduced in Rio, as I said, in 1992. Now, the two sides of it were, one was the COP, the Conference of the Parties. They do the political agenda. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they provide the science that supports what the COP are doing and recommending. And so that was the way it was set up. Let me step aside from that for a minute, Patrick, because one of the things that I have learned in my career is that, and most people still think this, the government commissions of inquiry are great things. You hear it every day. Oh, there's a conflict. Oh, well, why doesn't the commission or the government appoint a separate commission of inquiry? And they're called different terms. But in the public's mind, oh, that's good. We're going to get the politics out of this issue. It'll be an independent study. The very first commission of inquiry I ever got appointed to, I discovered that, in fact, it gives the politician even greater control. And not only that, but it takes them off of the political and media hook. Because if the media come along and say, well, what are you doing about this? Oh, I've got a commission of inquiry. I can't comment until the report comes in. They're now off the hook on the issue. But what they do is they go with the bureaucrats. They write the terms of reference for the commission. They predetermine the outcome of the commission. And I can tell you from my own experience, I was appointed to a commission of inquiry on water in a lake in Manitoba, Canada. It had been a conflict for 100 years. And finally, the minister said, okay, we'll have a commission. And I was appointed to the commission. We got the terms of reference. They were so restrictive, we couldn't possibly determine a solution because we couldn't even get access to the data. And so what I did was I went and said to the chairman of the commission, Mr. Duncan, I said, you tell the minister, either I get full access to all the information, or I'm going to go to the media and tell the media you're trying to predetermine the outcome of this commission. We got then, and the minister decided that was a bigger political threat than what he was doing. We got access to all the information, discovered documents, 100-year-old documents, written by an engineer in the area saying, here's the problem with the lake and here are the solutions. And there had been three commissions of inquiry since that time. Not one of them had acted on because the politician that had ordered the commission had moved on with his pension and retired, and the issue had got pushed aside. Let me illustrate my point for the Americans. One of the things about your old conspiracy theories, one of the biggest ones in the U.S. is the Warren Commission and who killed Kennedy. That's the great conspiracy theory. I watched Chief Justice Warren interviewed on American television, and the questioner said to him, why didn't you look at the mafia connection with Jack Ruby in Dallas? And Chief Justice Warren said very quietly and calmly, it wasn't in my terms of reference. I knew what he was saying. He was saying, I was told not to go there. But for most of the public, that comment would have gone completely over their heads. And that is why that whole thing, the Kennedy assassination, is such a conspiracy theory agenda on the internet today. Well, what Maurice Strong did when he set up the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was a commission of inquiry into climate change, he limited them by saying, you only look at human causes of climate change. That's the terms of reference they were given. And you can go and read that as Article 1 in the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, published in 1992. And the point is, and everybody listening, the scientists listening to your program will know, that unless you know how much the climate changes naturally, you can't possibly identify the human portion of that. But what did that term of reference allow? It allowed the IPCC, who the public think are looking at total climate change when they're not, they're only looking at human causes, it allowed them to limit what they looked at. So, for example, there are three greenhouse gases. That is, gases that are supposedly have the property of allowing sunlight into the Earth's atmosphere, heating the surface of the Earth, and then restricting the escape of that heat out to space. That's the greenhouse effect. The public are led to believe, because the IPCC only look at CO2, that it is the most important greenhouse gas. And of course, then what they argue from that, well, if the CO2 goes up, then the temperature will go up. But what the public are not told is CO2 is only 4% of the total greenhouse gases. The largest greenhouse gas by far is water vapor. It's 95%. But how do they get away from not looking at it? They just say, well, the amount of water vapor humans produce is so small relative to the total amount in the atmosphere that it's not important. So we'll just assume water vapor in the atmosphere is constant and ignore it. That's like saying, I'm going to look at my car, which is not running very well, but I'm going to ignore the engine, and I'm going to ignore the transmission, and I'm going to look at one nut on the right rear wheel, which is the CO2. And the focus even more narrow than that, because the nut represents all CO2, that is CO2 from natural sources. They're only looking at one thread within the nut, which is the human portion of the CO2, that's how much they've narrowed the focus by their terms of reference to the IPCC. That's how they've controlled the whole process. Now, of course, what the reason that you've been hearing more about natural events, this is going on, or more storms, more hurricanes, all that's occurring is perfectly natural. But because they don't look at what's natural, and they know the public don't know what is natural, they can get away with saying that what is natural is unnatural. And that's what's been happening. They've ramped that up in the last 24 months in anticipation of the Paris conference. And so this is why you're hearing all of these things, and every day there's another new scare, and it's all part of the political manipulation and the propaganda that's going on prior to the Paris conference. Now, by the way, just to back up for a minute on this, or to add to this, in order to shut down or make the developed nations, the industrialized nations, pay for their sins of producing CO2, they brought in the Kyoto Protocol. And the Kyoto Protocol was to say, we're going to limit the amount of CO2 that you developing nations are allowed to produce. We're going to tax you on that. We're going to make you pay a fine, became cap and trade. And we're going to take that money that you've made by causing global warming, and we're going to give that to the developing nations who've suffered because of your greed and your misuse of these resources. That's what the Kyoto Protocol was about. The United States Senate voted 95-0 against, because they said, look, it's not going to change anything, and all it's going to do is cost jobs and affect the economy negatively. So that created the difficulty. Nonetheless, they were still pushing through the Kyoto Protocol. And let's elaborate on this, because one of the things we've seen recently is that Putin in Russia has said that he's not in favor of Paris and what's going on. He doesn't accept the science of the global warming. He didn't accept it before. He sent his economic advisor by the name of Andrei Illarionov around the world making a PowerPoint presentation showing all the science of how bad the science on climate and global warming was. I attended one of those presentations in Vancouver, Canada. It was a very good presentation. You can get it on the internet still. Ilarionov went around the world saying Putin's not going to sign Kyoto. He doesn't believe in it. He went back to Moscow, and 3 months later, Putin announced he was signing Kyoto. Ilarionov resigned. He's now working at the Cato Institute in the United States. Say, well, why did Ilarionov resign, and why did Putin change his mind? Well, the problem they had with the Kyoto Protocol was twofold. One was that it was set up by saying we need 55 or we need enough countries that produce 55% of the CO2 that's going from human production. We need enough of those countries producing 55% of it to ratify the treaty to bring it into force. Because America said, we're not going to sign, then there were not enough countries that produced 55% to ratify the treaty. So they went to Putin and they blackmailed him. And Putin himself said this. You can Google this. It's right out there in the media. Putin said, they said to him, either you sign Kyoto or we will not support your application to be in the World Trade Organization. Putin, being the grossly practical politician that he is, said, okay, I'll sign Kyoto. He signed Kyoto. That's why he did it. And he said, I'm only doing it because I'm being blackmailed into it. And so now we've got this problem of Putin coming along now and saying he's not going to sign because he's decided developing his trade and his economy is far more important. But there was another thing that happened. Kyoto was going to be, with Putin's support, Kyoto was going to be ratified at the COP15. Now, that was the Conference of the Parties 15, was scheduled for Copenhagen. It was scheduled for November, and in what happened was that just prior to the conference in Copenhagen, somebody leaked all of the scientific information of what the scientists were doing that were controlling the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Again, your listeners can Google it. It's called ClimateGate. This was the release showing of how they were fixing the books, how they were controlling the peer review process, how they were isolating CO2 as the problem, how they had produced a hockey stick graph, which completely rewrote history. And that was enough, and it was done deliberately to derail the Kyoto Protocol, and it was enough to derail it. But, of course, they don't give up. What they did was, at Durban the next year, in COP16, they went to Durban. And, by the way, at these COPs, for example, the last one that was in Berlin, 6,000 people show up. Over 50% of them are non-government organization people. That is their Greenpeace, Sierra Club, and so on. So 50% of the membership of the COPs are the environmental groups pushing their agenda. But anyway, what happened in Durban was they stopped calling it Kyoto, and they introduced an idea that was called the Green Climate Fund. And this was a fund that all of the nations of the world were supposed to put in their money to pay for their sins of producing CO2. And the money is deposited into a bank account in South Korea, controlled by the IMF. And of course, that's part of what's being pushed in Paris. So they derailed it briefly with the ClimateGate exposure. And what happened after the ClimateGate exposure, they immediately commissioned inquiries to investigate it. In other words, they set up inquiries to show that, oh, no, the ClimateGate emails, there was nothing wrong with them. It was all just natural science. It was so bad that Clive Crook of The Atlantic magazine, a very, very good investigative journalist, he wrote and said, I thought that these commissions of inquiry investigating the scandal of the emails would do a good job. And he said, all they've done is whitewash It's a complete whitewash. And yet now the people that produced the hockey stick are wandering around saying, oh, no, we were exonerated. We didn't do anything wrong. And that all got swept under the table again. So now we're coming up to Paris. And now, of course, the Figueres, who's made a career out of this, she knows nothing about climate. In fact, 99% of the people that are going to be in Paris know nothing about climate. It's a purely political agenda. They're told what to say. They're told what to believe. And they vote the way that they're told. And that's where we are with the Paris conference. Now, there's other things going on in Paris that people need to know about, but I'll stop. I've kind of ranted on for maybe a little bit too long right now.
Well, sure. No, that's all important build up to this. You know, I'm curious about the IPCC. People hold them up as being some kind of a warehouse of data. You know, they look at it as some kind of an authority on climate change data, and yet, even in their own statement, they don't do any research whatsoever. And does that mean that it basically is just a political organization, the IPCC, rather than any kind of a scientific organization?
Oh, it's totally political. Because, see, one of the things that Maurice Strong is very good at is he's very good at organizing bureaucracies. And he knows that you can control pure politicians through bureaucracies. If you look at what's going on in the United States with the NOAA and the EPA and Obama using that bureaucracy in order to control people. And of course, as Mary McCarthy made the comment many years ago, bureaucracy, the rule of no one, the modern form of despotism. And that's what we're confronted with. But yes, the IPCC was set up by Maurice Strong, was a purely political organization. And proof of that is that he did it through the WMO, that is the World Meteorological Organization, which is a United Nations organization that is made up of the bureaucrats of every national weather office around the world. So every United Nations member has their weather office people as members of the WMO. So that way, they control the bureaucracy who then tell the politicians what they've got to pursue as policy. So NOAA have been dictating policy to the politicians. And of course, it's a beautiful scheme because if the politicians say, hey, hang on a minute, I got some problems. Well, are you an expert on climate? We're the World Meteorological Organization. We know all about this. How dare you question us? So it's very easy to block any political challenge to what was going on. And Richard Lindzen at MIT, who was on the IPCC, he finally gave up on it and said, look, all they're doing is using people from countries like, small countries that know nothing about climate, claiming to know what's going on about climate. Now, the other thing that they did at the IPCC to prove how political it was they produced the scientific reports, which, as you correctly point out, are not primary research. They don't do any. They simply look at the literature. But they only look at the literature that relates to human causes. So, for example, they don't look at any of the literature that's related to changes in the sun. They completely ignore all of the literature on changes in cosmic radiation and the changes in the sun's magnetic field and the changes in cloud cover on Earth that affects the climate. They don't look at any of that because it's not in their terms of reference. And so they limit it in that way. But they also, and this again is, and you have to admit, it's genius, but it's evil genius. The genius of Maurice Strong was that he set up three groups in the IPCC. There's the Working Group 1, which produces the physical basis of the science, right? And if you read that Working Group 1, it tells you all of the severe limitations of the science. They don't hide anything, but they know that nobody's going to read it or understand it. And anybody that does read it or understand it, like me, is very quickly and easily marginalized, always paid by the oil companies. It's very simple to shut me down, okay? The second group, Working Group 2, accept what Working Group 1 says. Working Group 1 says CO2 will increase because humans are producing it, and therefore the global temperature is going to go up. Working Group 2 then look at the impact of global warming on the world, but they start with the assumption that the world is going to warm, that there's no question about it. They never look at the positive side of global warming. And there are a lot of very good things about global warming. It's like somebody doing a cost-benefit analysis and only looking at the cost. That was set up deliberately. Working Group 3 then look at what are the policies that need to be introduced within our current system in order to mitigate against the damage of global warming. All right, so those are the three working groups that make up the 2,400 people that are members of IPCC. Virtually all of them are bureaucrats, or they are hand-picked scientists. Just to give you an example, when David Anderson, the Minister of Environment for Canada, went on television in Canada and said, "We have spoken to all Canadian climate scientists about the Kyoto Protocol, and they are all agreeing with us, and we're going to pursue it." Eight of us went to Ottawa at our own expense and held a press conference where we said, "Here's eight Canadian climate scientists that were not consulted by Mr. Anderson." What did Mr. Anderson do? He had not announced any policy on global warming. They hadn't done it. And Maurice Strong and other environmentalists kept pushing him about it. They hadn't come up with a policy. But all of a sudden, when we announced the date and the time of our press conference in Ottawa, Mr. Anderson announced that he was going to announce in the Houses of Parliament at exactly the same time his policy on global warming. Well, of course, that took all the media away from us. And we spoke to, I think, maybe four or five media people who were non-entities. This is how they deal with these issues. Now, so you've got those three working groups, Working Group 1, 2, and 3. Then, again, the genius of Maurice Strong, they set up a group called the Summary for Policymakers. That is a group that's completely independent of the IPCC, although there are one or two scientists that are handpicked to advise them. It's made up of politicians and bureaucrats, all handpicked. They produce the Summary for Policymakers. It is always released before the COP. Why? Because in the Summary for Policymakers, they say, "It's the end of the world, it's terrible, you must act." They do that because they know at the COP, the politicians there want the authority, the scientific authority, to introduce all sorts of draconian legislation, all sorts of taxation, and so on. But the Summary for Policymakers is what all of the media, in fact, they hold big press conferences on it. 9 or 10 months later, the science report of Working Group 1 is released. It gets no attention whatsoever because they've already made up their mind with the Summary for Policymakers. In other words, they deliberately deceive their own politicians through the Summary for Policymakers. This is all orchestrated to achieve this goal of deception, and it's the Summary for Policymakers. Now, the beauty of it is, of course, that if you push it, if you go and say, "Well, look, they've ignored this, if they ignored that." No, we talked about that. Go and read Working Group 1, the physical science basis. Yeah, we mentioned that in there. But when you go and read it, yeah, it says, "We don't know what we're doing. We focus on temperature. We know nothing about precipitation. We know nothing about this. We haven't got enough data." Yeah, it's all there, but nobody goes and reads it. So they're able to say, "Oh, yeah, well, we looked at those things, but that's not important," because they've already achieved their political agenda with the Summary for Policymakers, and that's what's happening in Paris again with COP21.
Right. So Paris, essentially, everything has been decided already as to what's going to happen in Paris. There'll be no new input. There'll be no new discussion. If a country or an individual connected to a country or an NGO or whatever would dare to stand up and say that I challenge this or I challenge that or I want to have this point discussed or whatever, they basically would be just shut down, is what you're kind of what you're saying. The agenda has been established, and the agenda will be performed.
Right, and of course, all the countries will go there. They'll come out with a manifesto. They always do. You know, they had some general statement that's already been written, by the way, and that they'll all agree to that. But here's the thing, and I'm going to use a Canadian example because this is what these politicians and people with specific agendas do. In Canada was created in 1867 by what's called the Fathers of Confederation. It's much like your founding fathers. They met in Charlottetown in Prince Edward Island in 1867. So in 1967, of course, they want to reiterate and revisit and all the rest of it. So all of the then provincial leaders of Canada, which are equivalent to the state governors, went to Charlottetown and had a meeting of the Fathers of to celebrate the Fathers of Confederation. All of the premiers came out after the meeting, which went on for 3 or 4 hours. They all came out, and I mean, the Premier of Ontario said, "Oh, very valuable meeting, very informative. We learned a great deal." Every one of them came out and said that, except one. And Joey Smallwood, the Premier of Newfoundland, that great province that did so well by the victims of the 9/11, when all the aircraft landed there and the Newfoundlanders looked after them so well, Joey Smallwood came out and he said to the media, "We met and we agreed to meet again," and he walked away. And you knew that was exactly what had happened in there. But this is what will happen in Paris. All of the countries will come out and say, "Yeah, we've signed the manifesto." When you actually look at the manifesto and understand what they're doing, you'll see that it's completely hollow, that there's nothing behind it. Because what's going on behind the scenes is that there is a global power struggle between the Western nations and what are called the BRICS nations. One of the nations that has challenged all along of what's going on with the IPCC and so on is India. I have worked with Indian climatologists. They're very good and very knowledgeable. We've got some Indo-Canadian climatologists, one by the name of Madhav Kandikar, who challenged all of this. The Prime Minister of India, Mr. Modi, set up a commission or a panel to look at what is the science and report to him on the science. They came back and said, it's all been orchestrated. The science doesn't support what's being said. Modi then did something very important that ties back to what we talked about earlier, because what they've done with the environmental issue is they took the moral high ground. When it became the religion, they said, "Oh, we care about the planet. We care about the children. We care about the future. You guys don't care." It became what I call eco-bullying. Well, what the Indian government have said is, look, what you're telling us is that you're claiming that the global temperature might go up half a degree Celsius, that is approximately 1 degree Fahrenheit, in the next 60 years. Might, possibly. You're not even certain about that. And on the basis of that, you're telling us to take draconian action to cut back economic development. And the Indian Prime Minister said, we've got people starving to death. We've got much greater priorities than that. And so what's happened is that changed the moral high ground of the debate that's going on. Now, the BRICS groups, that's an acronym that stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. They represent 48% of the world's population, and they also represent, and I forgot the exact number, but it's about 120, I believe it's 128, of the nations of the United Nations. In other words, they represent almost over 50%. And what they are doing is they're challenging the United Nations and its power. And they have set up a fund to offset the International Monetary Fund. They are, and of course, what they've also done is they've exploited what those using the United Nations to promote global warming did. Because, see, here's the problem with the United Nations. it's one country, one vote. So you could get a country like the Maldives. You say, well, why have we heard so much about them? That's such a puny little island out in the South Pacific. Oh, the Maldive government, they actually had cabinet meetings underwater to say, oh, the sea level's going to rise. They were exploited by these other nations because they had one vote at the United Nations. And these countries that were pushing the IPCC agenda knew that if they could get all of these small countries involved and say, oh, well, we're going to get you money. We'll get you money through the Kyoto. We'll transfer wealth to you. Of course, they're going to vote for you. But what was the option at the United Nations when they set it up? They could have said, no, well, we'll do it on population, that you'll get the number of votes based upon the size of your number of people. But that would have put China in control. Couldn't have that. Would have put India much more powerful. Oh, we can't have that. We've got these colonial powers with veto power in the General Assembly. So the structure of the United Nations was exploited by one side, is now being exploited by the BRICS nations to counteract the use of the United Nations that Maurice Strong did through the World Meteorological Organization. And one of the ways, by the way, that's interesting is that India, China particularly, essentially getting control of containerized shipping around the world. And one of the ways that you control the world is control the world's oceans. That's what the British Empire was built on. China is also looking at, with the support of the BRICS nations, building another canal through Nicaragua to offset the control that people have over the Panama Canal. So there's a lot of other machinations going on behind the scenes at Paris. But what will happen is it's still political suicide for most leaders to come out and question anything to do with the environment. And so they will say, oh, okay, yeah, we support this. But in fact, they're supporting it in name and words only. That's why Elaine Dewar named her book The Cloak of Green. Because what she wanted to do was write a book that praised Canadian environmentalists like Maurice Strong, like David Suzuki and all of these other people, Elizabeth May, the leader of the Canadian Green Party, who's going to Paris, by the way, as part of the Canadian delegation. So Elaine Dewar said, hey, these are great people. They're doing great things. She started her investigation, discovered that these people were more manipulative and more corrupt than the people that they were attacking. So she ended up writing the book and titling it The Cloak of Green. I spoke to Elaine about 6 years ago and said, it's time that you updated the book. She said, I was death threats. I wouldn't touch it. I wouldn't go near it. I'd never do it again. That's why investigative journalism has been shut down. And so this is, what, of course, what's going on. And by the way, what's interesting, Patrick, is the United Nations, I don't know how it happened, but they ended up asking people, 6 million people around the world, what are your greatest concerns? And they listed 14 that they had to tick off as their greatest concern. 14th on their list of concerns was climate change. It was the lowest. When you look at the Pew Center polls on social concerns for Americans, global warming is down at 28 on a list of 32 or whatever it is. It is not a concern for the public. But yet the politicians still are afraid to say anything because they are going to get attacked by that minority of fanatics who are dictating to the rest of the world. And the way that I express that and phrase that is, it's always been that the tail wagged the dog. But what you got now is the flea on the hair on the tail is wagging the dog. And you can see how effective it's going to be at Paris, where Christian Figueres, who's made a career out of this, will bully all of these world leaders into signing a manifesto that actually is simply window dressing for a big lie.
Right, right. One last topic I think I'd like to throw out and just get your opinion on. There has been a number of reports lately not probably appearing in the New York Times necessarily, but I've seen some reports float by that certain meteorologists and climatologists are predicting that we're actually moving into a mini, or at least a cooling period, based on solar activity and some other factors and so on that they're talking about. And this is, it kind of brings to mind that the big scare back in the 1970s was global cooling.
Yep.
And there's been a flip-flop from that to global warming. And the reports I've seen have been largely ignored by anybody else, of course. But what do you think at this point? What's your assessment of the possibility of outright global cooling in the next 30 years?
I think it's almost inevitable. And let me again, the historic context is so important in all of this. During the Cold War, and as you said, from 1940 to 1980, the world temperature was going down. Some of the older people will remember 1947 as a brutally cold year. So, of course, they were coming out saying, oh, cooling. Lowell Ponte wrote a book called The Cooling. Stephen Schneider, who became one of the great promoters of global warming, was also saying global cooling is the greatest threat. The CIA wrote three reports that I know about talking about the threat of global cooling and its impact on world food production and the social and political unrest that would follow from that. So, yeah, that was what was going on then. But it wasn't a political agenda at that point. It only became a political agenda after 1980 when a warming trend did occur. But the warming trend was a natural warming trend. It was due to changes in the sun. It was due to changes in the solar cycle. Now, that word cycle is very important because during the Cold War, there was a big debate developed between the Western world and the Eastern world. And by the Eastern world, basically I'm saying Russia or Soviet Union as it was then, and China. Now, I know about all of this because I was working in the West, but I had also worked with Soviet climatologists, Borisenkov in particular, who had reconstructed climate change in Russia for the last 1,000 years, and also with Chinese climatologists who were looking to increase their food production in their cold regions of Manchuria and the North, and they wanted to look at how Canada was producing more food in a similar climate. So there was a lot of contact going on. But here's what happened. The Chinese and the Soviets have always believed that climate is cyclical, that there's a bunch of cycles going on, solar cycles, ocean cycles, cycles in the cosmology and everything else, and that all you have to do is sort out all of the various cycles, which then overlap and create a net climate. And if you could sort out, so it's kind of like being outside of a stadium and you hear a noise, that's a white noise, but it's made up of the individual red noises of every person in the stadium. So in order to understand the climate and what are the contributing noises, you have to be able to track it back to those individual noises. Now, that was the Eastern view. And to the extent that the Soviets had already been looking at climate cycles affecting their crop productions, and there was a thing called the Kondratiev cycle or the K cycle. It's still being used by people in the stock market. In fact, the stock market is one of the biggest users of climate cycles to predict stock trends. Okay, so that was the Eastern view. The Western scientific view was saying, oh no, it's chaos theory, that it's all unpredictable, it's chaos theory. That's where that comment about, oh, if a butterfly flaps its wings in Japan, you get a storm on the west coast of the United States, you know, 1 month later and so on. That's where all of that came from. The media interpreted all of this as a political division. It wasn't. It was a pure scientific difference in how they viewed climate and causes of climate. The IPCC, of course, have adopted the chaos theory view. And I used to tease them, and I still do. I say, you better hope the chaos theory is right, because it might explain why all of your predictions about weather and climate are so wrong. And that's the interesting part about this, because every prediction they've made, and they stopped calling them predictions, they started calling them projections. Every one they've made has been wrong. Well, if your predictions are wrong, your science is wrong. End of story. That's what the great physicist Feynman said. If your prediction is wrong, your science is wrong. But they ignored that. And so this is the pattern. Now, the solar cycles, we've known for a long time that the number of sunspots correlates with global temperature. So when there are a lot of sunspots, the Earth is warmer. When there are very few sunspots, the Earth is colder. But as you know, and in science, correlations do not indicate cause and effect. You have to be extremely dangerous. When I taught a science credit for art students, I spent a whole lecture talking about this danger of cause and effect and correlation. And one of my favorite ones was that Diet Coke causes obesity. Because if you do a scientific study, you find that more people that are obese drink Diet Coke than any other group. Therefore, it's the Diet Coke that's causing the obesity. Well, we knew that there was this relationship, correlation, I should say, between sunspots and temperature. But we didn't have the cause and effect mechanism. So the IPCC quite correctly argued, well, we ignore that. We're not going to look at that. They also ignored it, of course, because they argued that humans don't have any, they don't contribute to what the sun is doing. We have no part in that. So they could ignore it based upon their definition. But what happened was in 1991, a couple of scientists by the name of I've got to get them correct, Christiansen and it doesn't matter, but Christiansen was one of them. And then he joined later with a guy by the name of Heinrich Svensmark. And Svensmark in 1992 came out with what's called the Svensmark theory or the cosmic theory. And he came up with the mechanism that explains the relationship with sunspots and global temperature. What the sunspots are manifestations of changes in the whole activity within the sun, and it particularly manifests in changes in the strength of the sun's magnetic field. Now, the sun's magnetic field strength controls the amount of cosmic radiation coming from deep space and arriving on Earth. Those particles of cosmic radiation, as they pass through the atmosphere, in the lower atmosphere, become what are called condensation nuclei. That is, they become little particles that are necessary for water vapor, a gas, to condense onto to become a water droplet. Now, a water droplet is extremely small. That's what the clouds are made up of, water droplets. But there are billions of them in a cloud. That's why you can see the cloud. To give you an idea of how small a water droplet is, it takes approximately 1 million of them to get together to form a medium-sized raindrop. Okay? So one of the things that we knew was that there was more cloud than there were condensation nuclei, that is these little particles around which the water vapor could condense. The ones that we knew about in the atmosphere were clay particles coming from the surface of the Earth, but also salt particles. We knew about those, but there weren't enough of them in the atmosphere to explain the amount of cloud that was being created. Well, the Svensmark theory then explained that, and what he showed was that as the number of sunspots, which were just a manifestation of changes on the sun, as the sun's magnetic field changed, that controlled the amount of low cloud cover in the Earth's atmosphere. The low cloud cover, of course, then determined how much of the heat from the sun reached the surface of the Earth, which, of course, controls the global temperature. That has been in the literature since 1992, the cosmic theory, but it's not even mentioned in the IPCC reports. Those solar cycles are tracked back. We started the first cycle. It's called the Wolf number. It starts in 1747. Galileo was the first to plot sunspot numbers, and that was in 1610. So we know the variability of sunspot numbers. So from that, the solar cycles are created. There's an 11-year sunspot number, and then there's a 22-year sunspot number, and the 22-year sunspot number is the one that really controls the temperature. So the Soviets, and now the Russian climatologists and the Chinese climatologists, are the ones that are saying that as the sunspot numbers decrease, and by the way, they were increasing up to 1990, they've been decreasing ever since. That is why the global temperature has been decreasing since 2000, and it's been causing all the problems for the IPCC. And that's why we're predicting, and I agree with them, that I would say with 97% certainty that we're heading into a cooling phase because the sunspot numbers are decreasing. This year, we're in sunspot cycle number 25, starting, as I said, in 1747. The sunspot numbers are as low as they were in 1800, which was a period called the Dalton Minimum, and we had very cold temperatures around the world at that time. That is almost for certain where we're headed. We're heading into global cooling. And what's so frustrating about this is because of their single-mindedness and their deliberate single-mindedness, the government are preparing us for warming when cooling is a much greater threat. And all you have to do is go and read the CIA reports from the 1970s to understand why cooling is a much greater threat.
That's interesting. I think we're going to see more about this in the future. I hope more people will pick up on it and write about it and just put it out there for the public to consume. Although, as you mentioned, the public is not really, they're not really caught up in the global warming thing anyway, but I wouldn't, they might not even be caught up in the global cooling thing if they learned about that. But certainly as a political structure, the United Nations is coming under increasing scrutiny and skepticism amongst the public. Unfortunately, as you kind of alluded to, the public really doesn't have a lot of control over what happens within this organization, and they can't really be causative in any way because it's the leaders of their countries that are actually doing this. So,
there's a very interesting point with that because I took seniors on tours of Europe, and took them to Pompeii on three different occasions. On one of the trips, we just went and looked at graffiti in Pompeii, and after the eruption of Vesuvius in 74 BC or AD, they were having an election at the time. One of the pieces of graffiti in Pompeii says, if we get rid of this bunch of scoundrels, we just get another bunch of scoundrels. And so the public know that it doesn't make any difference if you change leadership. You just get people that have personal political agendas. The only time, and I've spent a great career looking at what causes political change in response to, when do the public finally say, as Popeye said, that's all I can stand, I can stand no more. There's two factors. One is two factors that cause political change. The first one is when there's a failure of the food supply. One of the great myths that's been created by the Obama administration was the Arab Spring. And they pointed at Egypt and said, oh, it's democracy breaking out in the Middle East. It was not at all. The riots in Egypt were totally about the increasing cost of food. And why was that occurring? It was occurring because the governments were subsidizing ethanol production from corn, which pushed the price of corn up, which made the basic food supply for the poor people go up around the world. That's what caused the riots in Egypt. It had nothing to do with democracy. Those are countries that have no democracy at any level. So That's what triggered the French Revolution. They had two consecutive years of harvest failure. The first year, the price of a loaf of bread went up to 55% of a peasant family's total income just for one loaf of bread. And then the second year of harvest failure, they were 87% of their income went just to get bread. The third year, of course, they said, that's enough. We've got to get rid of the government. They stormed the Bastille and the French Revolution begins. It, of course, was a total disaster because they just ended up with more of the same. The other thing that causes people to revolt against their leadership is when the leaders forget that they only are there at the will of the people. So even in monarchies and dictatorships, if the leaders start to put out the word that that the people have no control over anything, that they are there by, for example, the divine right, as Charles I said. And what did they do? We'll show you divine right. We'll cut your head off. And what did Louis XVI say? L'état, c'est moi. I am the state. Okay, Louis, here's your head on a platter. And of course, when you look at what's going on with Obama and what's going on with governments around the Canadian government, the new Liberal government. Oh, we know what's best for you. We are here to save you from yourselves. You're too stupid. And of course, at that point, people start to rise up. So those are the only two things where the people will actually push to change the government. The rest of the time, they simply try to adapt and survive. And hopefully they'll come to their senses with what's going on in Paris.
Yes, we can hope for a better outcome, but we'll see. We don't have long to wait either. Well, our time is up for this interview, Dr. Ball. I just so greatly appreciate you taking the time and, in a sense, giving us a college lecture here on this stuff. This is absolutely fantastic stuff. Now, these are things that we don't hear. We don't, you know, life doesn't live on a bumper sticker, you know, where you just have three words or something to say about something. And there is background to everything. And you've been there, you've done it, you've lived it, you've experienced it, you interacted with a lot of these people. And hearing your perspective on all of these things is I think it's really important for people to understand. There are still people who care about history a little bit and who care about the more detailed look. I'm one of them, I think, but I wish there was more for sure. I'm sure you've run across that. But listen, I hope we can leave the door open to do additional interviews in the future. As these things unfold, as the climate change issue unfolds in the next year, I've got a feeling that there will be some very interesting turns and twists that will maybe surprise us. And so there will be more to talk about, I think, in the future.
Yeah. Just to pick up on that last point, to tie this back in with what we started out with, bumper stickers are, for the average person, the modern philosophy. You know, one of the things that the environmental movement, they were pushing was, well, we've got to get rid of the people. The bumper sticker came out and said, save the planet, kill yourself. It succinctly summarizes the whole situation. What they did through the United Nations Environment Program and Maurice Strong, they created bumper sticker slogans. You mentioned one of them, sustainable development. That term came out of a commission produced or put forward and created by the Club of Rome, chaired by Gro Harlem Brundtland, who was the socialist prime minister of Norway. And she coined that, her commission coined that term, sustainable development. It's the perfect political term because, as I've said, it means everything to everyone and nothing to anyone. And it's just like any of these things. When you start to think about it and parse it, you suddenly realize, well, what are they really saying here? That came to my understanding when I was asked to do a study on sustainable agriculture. Then I said, well, sustainable agriculture makes sense because now I've got the noun agriculture and I've got the adjective sustainable. I can identify that. But in sustainable development and sustainable are both adjectives. It's a meaningless phrase. And not only that, but development means constant growth, which in the human body is cancer. And you can sustain constant growth. So the term is an oxymoron.
Yes, if you
turn it around and say we need to develop a sustainable society, then it makes some sense. But they didn't want that. They wanted a catchphrase that would, as I said, mean everything to everyone and nothing to anyone. And that, so they're the bumper stickers of the whole environmental movement.
Yes, indeed. And I have one bumper sticker of my own to totally confuse them. And that is the concept of sustainable liberty.
And yes.
We can hope for that in the future. Well, Dr. Ball, we will talk again in the future, I'm sure. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And I hope that that you can continue to have a great impact up in Canada and around the world, for that matter, too. You already have. Keep up the good work.
Well, thank you. And as the Jewish proverb says, truth doesn't die, it just lives a miserable existence.
Amen.